Welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for listening to the ORN Sport on this Tuesday evening.
We will be discussing over the next hour all the sports news from the past week and previewing what's to come over the next 7 days.
Murray wins! Murray wins it all! This is going to be a tough play.
Is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show. I'm your host Matt Webb and I'm joined in the studio by quite a large panel today. We've got Ollie, James, Fred and Sam. It's going to be an eclectic mix. We're going to be discussing the Winter Olympics, the Six Nations, Rugby League and the 2020 series in cricket. But first of all, we're going to kick off the show by talking about the Winter Olympics, the big event in Pyeongchang, which has been going on at the moment. Now, this is the time of year when we all get a bit obsessed with curling, which we try to remember the rules of ice hockey, and we hear about something called short track speed skating, which is what we're going to start with. One of our main British medal hopes, Elise Christie, had a bit of a mare today, didn't she, Sam, in a 500 metre short track
indeed.
Final.
Yeah.
So what went on there?
Kicked off in Pyeongchang on Friday, with Great Britain looking to match or beat the record of four medals set in 1924 and 2014. Focusing on the big story, which, as you've said, was GB's Elise Christie crashed out of the 500 metres short track speed skating final, an event she currently holds the world record in. She said she was pushed and didn't fall on her own, and as many have seen, her interview was actually really sad. She was absolutely distraught, seeing as she was disqualified in all three of her events in Sochi 4 years ago. Despite this, she has got two more events in the 1000 and 1500, and she is the current world champion in both of those, so she could bring that back around, but, you know, she did look absolutely distraught. Anyone else watching, there was a photo finish between Italy's Fontana and the South Korea Choi Min Jeong, but Choi Min Jeong was eventually disqualified, so Christie did ultimately come fourth. Looking ahead to my favourite, alpine ski racing, the only event that's actually gone ahead so far is the men's combined, as the women's giant slalom was postponed owing to high winds. In that, Marcel Hirscher won, a long-awaited medal, to be honest. My dad will be happy with that one. And the two Frenchmen, Alexis Pinterau and Maffei Jondé, taking 2 and 3 respectively. There was a bit of drama actually in the men's luge, with the German Felix Loch coming fifth, who was the favourite, and the Austrian Gleischer winning, which is a great achievement because I think he's only previously come fourth in the World Championship, so great for him. Snowboarding in the men's half pipe, the infamous Sean White, as many would have heard, won, with the Aussie Scotty James coming second, and Ayu Hiranu coming third for Japan. US also took first in the men's slope style, and both women's halfpipe and slope style going to the Americans as well. Tomorrow's a big day for GB, with pressure on the men's and women's teams to perform in the as they both got bronze and silver last year. Sorry, in the curling last year, as they got bronze and silver for the men's, bronze for the women's. As you said, men have been focusing on that recently. Women's slalom skiing tomorrow, something I will be watching with the favourite Michaela Schifrin, but two Britons competing, so that'll be good to watch. The medal table currently sees Germany at the top with 5 golds, Netherlands second with 4th, but one more overall medal, Norway, Canada and the US all with 3 golds, GB yet to get on the board, but hopefully that will change tomorrow.
Yeah, so what are you looking at as our best hopes for in GB? I've heard that we've had some really strong runs in the skeleton in practice, apparently. The likes of Lizzie Yarn are perhaps looking to repeat her success in Sochi. So do you think that's a real possibility?
Yeah, I think it's the curling is tomorrow. I don't want to put too much pressure if they're listening, which they probably aren't. They're probably in bed or something. But yeah, hopefully they can emulate their success from last year. Also, Dave Riding, the alpine skier, has been doing really, really good recently. I spoke about him last term, actually, about how well he's been doing. If he could get a medal or even a gold, which is possible, that would be really good for snow sports in general, I think.
Yeah, one thing that I noticed from reading about the games, well, there's somebody's actually been banned for doping already. The Japanese speed skater Kai Sato has been excluded from an out-of-season test. How normal is it for people to be done for doping at the Winter Olympics? I know we hear a lot about it at the Summer Olympics. Yeah. That's like most of what we know about. But do you think there'll be more people to come?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, infamously the Russians now compete under Olympic athletes from Russia, so not actually competing for Russia. They are quite, you know, it's quite a big story, them being done for doping. Going back to our medals in 2014, Britain actually might get a fifth medal, seeing as Russia was banned in the bobsleigh. So
that'll be an all-time record.
Then it'll be a record. Yeah, so you know, every cloud has a silver lining, especially for the Brits on that respect. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously not as big story as the Summer Olympics, but you know, there clearly is doping, and it's not just unique to Russia.
If we come back to Elise Christie for a second, she was seen as perhaps not quite our golden girl, but she was certainly seen as one of our key medal contenders. And obviously, this has been a big setback for her. But her favourite event is the 1,000 metres. Do we think that she could have quite a decent chance of getting a medal in that?
Yeah, well, she does hold the current world champion for 1,000 and 1,500. So she could definitely, she's got the skill, holds a world record for, you know, the 500 she lost today. If she can, you know, really bounce back, then there's no doubt in my mind that she won't do well. But yeah, again, it's going to be hard, seeing as she was gutted and she still claims that she was pushed. And if you look at the replay, it was brushed on her hand. So, you know,
I suppose when you're going at that speed as well, it's not hard to take a tumble.
Yeah, yeah. And it's such a short time. I mean, it's like 40 seconds. So, you know, it's quite easy to fall over in that state.
Yeah. One last thing. I noticed that a 17-year-old American snowboarder, Chloe Kim, won the half pipe gold. Was that a pretty unexpected thing to happen, or is she an up and coming person?
Yeah. Well, as I said, the Americans are quite, you know, they're big on the snow sports, but they're also quite cool. So they're going to be quite good at the snow sport, snowboard even. But yeah, no, they're infamously good at the snowboard kind of freestyle events, halfpipe. I think they got two in the women's halfpipe, the gold and the bronze. So yeah, they always have a lot competing at a high level in that level.
Now going to be moving on to the Six Nations, which I think is something that we can all hold forth with a lot more authority on. So it's obviously been a very busy weekend in the championships, the second match weekend, and the first one we're going to talk about is probably the biggest game of the weekend: England versus Wales. A tightly fought game. England came out victorious 12 points to 6 with two first half Johnny May tries making the difference between the two teams. But before we get on to the actual match itself, the big issue to address is the actual whether or not Gareth Anscombe should have scored a try. Now, World Rugby have actually come out and said that the TMO made a mistake not awarding a try. So what do you guys think? Was it a try? Did Anthony Watson get his hands under the ball sufficiently, or did Gareth Anscombe ground it?
Well, I'm really surprised that World Rugby have come out and said that, because I think even though initially most people thought that the TMO had got the decision wrong, because clearly Anthony Watson didn't get to the ball first, so I can't really understand where that logic had come from. I think further replay showed that Steph Evans actually knocked the ball on in the build-up to that, which wasn't initially picked up or shown on the replays. So ultimately, the right decision was made, not through the correct logic, but yeah, it does surprise me that World Rugby have come out and said that, because I don't think Wales can feel quite as hard done by as they initially thought they had been.
Apparently, it was said, I think it was Foley, he said that, oh, they've told me that they were wrong. But yeah, I think even if they had awarded the try, I don't think it would necessarily have affected the result as everyone's thinking. It was not going to suddenly make Wales win the game. There's still a lot of the game left to be played after that.
I think England would have shown a lot more intent, perhaps, if Wales had scored a try. So I think it's life is full of ifs and buts, and I don't think you can sort of reflect on that as to the reason why Wales lost the game, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, when I first watched it, obviously I'm an England fan, but I didn't think there was any kind of clear grounded. But as Ollie said, that in the build-up play there was a knock-on, I think it was. So yeah, no, the try didn't stand. It shouldn't have stood. And not only that, I think they're kind of, the Welsh kind of clutching at straws now, seeing as, you know, England are kind of dominating not just the Six Nations but the World Rugby, obviously apart from New Zealand. But yeah, it seems like they're just clutching at straws, if I'm honest.
There was no real threat, I didn't think, from Wales throughout the game. You'd have thought, you know, decision like that, if it had gone in their favour, would have galvanised them for the second half, and going against them, you would have expected some kind of a response in the second half. And whilst they had some kind of periods of sustained pressure, I think England were pretty comfortable in the end. So I think the decision had very little impact upon the course of the game.
I think it's further proof as well that VAR isn't quite as effective as some people might think it is. There's obviously been that huge debate in football as to whether we should implement it more, and there's been a lot of decisions recently which have proved that maybe it shouldn't be implemented. But I think, yeah, obviously people have used rugby as an example of how it can work effectively, but I think the weekend just highlighted that it doesn't matter like how many angles you look at, if the person looking at the actual footage doesn't make the right decision, then there's always going to be wrong decisions in sport regardless of how much technology is implemented.
Yeah, I think it's always going to be a bit of human error involved in that. But I think we've covered that now. I think that's something we had to address. So I think we can move on to the actual rugby game itself. England, I think, had the edge under the high ball, Fred. Do you think that was important in their victory?
Yeah, I think that's like something they definitely targeted Wales with as well. I think they targeted Steph Evans and I can't remember who the fullback was named now, but the young guy.
Iscombe.
Yes, oh yeah, yeah. I think they're definitely targeting them. Under the high ball, and I think it worked out very well. Anthony, I think Mike Brown did have a good game.
Man of the match,
man of the match indeed. Not his biggest fan. He never seems to pass the ball ever.
No, I think I'm with you there. He gets the ball and then he decides he's going to have a little run towards them and gets tackled.
Sometimes he wants past it, and I was like, oh, I'll put it with a run there myself. But that's why I'm not on the pitch, to be fair. So I mean, I'm standing back here commenting on Mike Brown, but and he always seems to be in fights. If there's ever a fight, he's always there.
He loves it.
Apparently, he's called the Angry Man or something. That's what they call him.
He never ever looks happy, does he? So.
He doesn't particularly, to be honest. But I think Ollie, you were saying whilst we were off air there that Eddie Jones has come out in support of Mike Brown because he's coming for some area of criticism from some areas of the media, perhaps saying that he was perhaps not getting past it a little bit, but perhaps moving in that direction.
Yeah, so Eddie Jones has come out in support of Mike Brown, who he's obviously made vice captain, so I think he obviously has to come to his defence, but he sort of launched a scathing criticism on all worldwide rugby journalists, saying that they've been completely unfair on Mike Brown and that he's never had a bad game for England under his leadership, which is like completely unfair because he has. I think everyone here would probably agree that Mike Brown's time's up. He's had some great games for England in the past, but I think Fred touched upon it just now on how he never seems to pass the ball. His main strength always used to seem to be that he'd beat the first man. He'd always seemingly get over the game line, but he doesn't do that now. He just seems to get tackled every time he gets the ball and doesn't seem to have a cutting edge or a turn of pace that, let's say, Elliot Daly has shown since he's played for England. So, yeah, I think Mike Brown's time is seemingly up. Eddie Jones is trying to come out in support of him, which I think he's done for a few players in the past. I remember a year or so ago, the same sort of thing happened with George Ford when he had a really poor game against Wales, and Eddie Jones attacked every journalist under the sun, saying that they were being completely unfair, and George Ford was one of the best fly halves in the world. So that's good from his perspective, defending his players. But, yeah, I would be surprised if Mike Brown is in the team in the next year or so. I think this could probably be his last Six Nations.
To be fair, George is a god. Just going to say that. Yeah.
Oh, I love
him. A completely unbiased bar property fan.
Entirely. Well, he's not in there
anymore. He's god, apart from the fact he can't kick a ball, but.
No. That's very true.
James, England's defence was resolute in the match against Wales, and I think that's been an area that everyone's noted since Eddie Jones came into charge, that England's defence has tightened up a lot. How important do you think that's been for them in this Six Nations?
It's been vital. I mean, I watched the Italy game and, you know, they conceded a fair few points in that one, probably more than many would expect going into a game against, well, definitely the weakest side within the competition. To win a competition like the Six Nations, you have to really build from your defensive base and from solidity. And England proved on at the weekend against Wales that they have a really solid base. It seems like that's what Eddie Jones kind of builds England's game around, being resolute, being resilient, being strong. And that was illustrated by the performance of the weekend for sure.
Yeah, well, I think we've concluded that it was England were probably good for the win, we'd have to say. The controversy over the TMO decision will, I'm sure, linger with Wales, but at the end of the day, it's a win for England, they move forwards. I think we move on to perhaps among one of the closest games of the weekend, if not the closest, was Scotland versus France, with Scotland coming out 32 points, 26 winners. But it didn't always look that way, did it, Fred? It was an early lead for France in that game.
Yeah, I felt a bit sorry for France, actually. I thought they played much better than they have done for years, to be honest. They actually looked like they had some passion about the game for once. You could hear the French supporters in the stadium as well. That was one of the craziest things I've ever heard. That 2 minutes in when they got the score, you could hear the French supporters over the Scottish in Murrayfield, and they can barely pack out their own stadiums, let alone get a travelling contingent. So I thought that was pretty good. But yeah, they sort of just seem to taper out a little bit at the end and play for themselves. But somehow, I'm sure they'll probably manage to make the semi-finals of the World Cup again somehow. Always the way.
Yeah. I thought Greg Laidlaw played well. Obviously, he's kind of central to that Scotland team, to be honest. I rate him as a player quite a lot, to be honest. But yeah,
there was one moment there, wasn't there, where he decided to run past the ball in the France scored a try.
But he was kicking really well. Obviously, that eventually won them the game, didn't it? I thought obviously whoever kind of lost that wasn't really in contention at all for the Six Nations, so France kind of out of it. But as you said, probably going to be in the semi-final of the World Cup, if not the final. Always,
I think the promising thing that Scotland can take from that game is that they managed to win the game without playing anywhere near their best. They didn't seem like they were playing anywhere near the style of rugby that they were playing in the autumn internationals against the likes of New Zealand and Australia, but they still came away with I wouldn't say solid victory because it was quite tight near the end, but
I think they showed quite a lot of resilience, really. They did.
And there was only I think they only scored 2 tries in the game, a lot of penalty goals kicked, so yeah, it was a very pleasing victory on that front. I'll touch on France a sec though. I think they look like a new and improved team under Jacques Brunel. I think that was a fantastic appointment by the French Rugby Association. I think he's a much respected member of or much respected by a lot of the players and staff alike, and I think it's important to remember that France are without a couple of their key players. Wesley Fofana, who's arguably been one of their best players in the past 4 or 5 years, and also Bryce Delan, who's a very exciting fullback who's been a great player on the European scene in recent years. They're without both of them, so once they come back into the equation, and if you sort of combine that with a lot of their new and exciting talent, is it Thomas on the wing,
Telly Thomas
he scored a couple of really good tries for France there, showed some real pace against them. I think he'll score a really good try against Ireland the week before. James, Scotland quite direct in their approach, weren't they? So really going hard at the French in a similar way to the Irish. Do you think this is the way to go about beating France?
I think so, just kind of building off what Ollie was saying about Scotland, how impressive it was for them to win the game, particularly on the back of such a disappointing result and performance the week before against Wales, and against a team in France who lost in such narrow circumstances to Ireland. They would have had a real point to prove going into the game and really be buoyed and you know, kind of aggressive in their approach ahead of it. But Scotland kind of appeared a bit of a different game plan from them, a lot more direct, like you say, reliant on the kicking of Greg Laidlaw at the end. But that seemed to be the approach. I mean, I'm not the biggest rugby union fan in the world, but in recent years, kind of France is kind of synonymous with physicality, with strength in the pack, and that appears to be the case in this tournament as well. So the best way to get round them is you know, beating them in the arm wrestle, and that's what Scotland certainly did at the weekend.
Yeah, and just quickly before we move on to the Ireland-Italy game, Sam, Scotland, how important was it for them mentally to be able to come back from 10 points to nil down after they were thrashed by Wales the week before?
Yeah, I think especially with the hype that they've recently received, and then losing by such a large margin against Wales, that if they lost to France, I think they'd be demoralised, and that might even continue into, like, you know, the autumn internationals where they keep playing badly. But yeah, I think now that they've won, if they get another convincing win, obviously this wasn't that convincing, but if they get another convincing win and really play to their best and prove to themselves and to everyone else that they can play so well, they will definitely be a force to be reckoned with, especially in a few years. Touch on kind of what Ollie was saying about France as well, I think in a few years they'll be a force to be reckoned with as well, and the Six Nations, you know, in 2-3 years or so will be a really, really entertaining, and not just be kind of 2-3 teams competing. I really think it will be 5 even 6 if Italy get their stuff together. It'll be a really entertaining series every year, but yeah, especially Scotland.
I just wanted to touch on another Scottish player, Hugh Jones, who I don't think gets anywhere near enough credit. I'd probably say he's the most underrated player in world rugby at the minute.
Controversial.
I think he's a phenomenal player to watch. I think a lot of the reason why Scotland the Scottish brand of rugby has seemingly changed in the last year or couple of years or so is because of him. He's sort of plied his trade in South Africa. I think he had a few seasons with the Stormers, and that's where he grew up playing his rugby. So he was obviously used to playing that attacking style of rugby. Playing in the Super Rugby, or yeah, the Super Rugby has obviously helped him as well. So I think obviously you've got to give a lot of credit to Greg Townsend and what he's done since he's taken over. But I think the key to Scottish success in the future and how well they do in this Six Nations is Hugh Jones and whether or not they can keep him fit.
Yep, I think that really wraps up our discussion on the Scotland-France match. Before we move on to our previews for the rest of the Six Nations, we're just going to talk about Ireland-Italy quickly. So obviously I think we've seen two different Ireland really this week, haven't we, James, in the last 2 weeks. You know, a very narrow win against France, and then they absolutely blew Italy away with some really exciting wide play from their backs.
Yeah, it was a fantastic performance. I mean, I spoke to my granddad's Irish, and he was jubilant. He'd been jubilant the last 2 weeks about the performances and the manner of victories. I listened to Joe Smith's interview though after the game, and he was quite critical of the Ireland's defence in that they allowed Italy to score probably again, like England the previous week, probably too many points, if you know what I mean. But yeah, a very expansive performance from Ireland, and I think they're a bit of a dark horse in the competition this year. They're kind of quietly going under the radar. Everybody's focus was on Scotland, obviously, initially. England are the clear favourites for the tournament, but I wouldn't take your eye off Ireland just yet. I think that they've got a number of quality players, a coach who's done a fantastic job there, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're in the running come the end of the tournament.
Yeah, and I mean, Conor Murray is perhaps one of the better players for Ireland and in the Six Nations generally. Ollie, just how good is he?
Oh, I think he's exceptional. I think other than the two New Zealand scrum halves in Aaron Smith and TJ Perenara, you're probably looking at him as probably the next best scrum half in the world. I think he was very unlucky not to win player of the tour for the Lions as well. I think that went to Jonathan Davis in the end, but Conor Murray was the sort of, he was the heart of that Lions team. He was probably the reason why we did so well over there. And yeah, he really is an exceptional player, and he proved that at the weekend. Going back to Ireland in general, though, I think I said in our Six Nations preview that I think Ireland are the strongest team on paper, and I completely stand by that. I think at the moment they've got the perfect mix between their seasoned internationals with the likes of Conor Murray, Johnny Sexton, their back row with CJ Stander, Sean O'Brien, Rory Best, their captain, at the heart of that team, combined with a lot of the young up-and-coming talent who have performed so well for the likes of Leinster in Europe this season, the likes of Jacob Stockdale, who scored two fantastic tries at the weekend, Jordan Lama, who came on at the end, who I think is one of the hottest prospects in world rugby at the minute. He scored some outstanding solo tries for Leinster this season. So I think, yeah, they've definitely got the perfect mix of young internationals coupled with the seasoned talent, which have played so well for them over the years. One thing I would say though is I think their defence looked relatively shaky against Italy compared to the likes of England that we touched upon. They did concede three tries, and I think that could stand England in good stead going into the all important final game at Twickenham in a few weeks time.
Oh no, I was just going to say, as an England fan, I'm actually quite worried about it, to be honest. Obviously their defence wasn't the best. I don't think it's as good as England. But their attacking game is just so strong, and kind of the partnership of Conor Murray, as you said, I think that in the Lions tour is phenomenal. I think those two at 9 and 10 are a massive threat to England. I think Eddie Jones will focus on that, but I think that is the biggest problem there. I mean, their backs are phenomenal. I think their front row is obviously, they're very good players, but kind of underrated in what they do in a match. I think it like last year, England-Ireland, will be a problem for England, definitely.
Yeah, well, I think that brings us to a conclusion, our review of the weekend's matches in the Six Nations. Just before we go to a quick song break, guys, have your opinions as to who's going to win the Six Nations changed after the first 2 weeks? I think Fred's looking smug about his Scotland predictions over there. I definitely recall me, Ollie and James and co predicting that Scotland would have quite a good chance. But Fred, you haven't been surprised by Scotland's collapse against Wales?
No, I wasn't. I was before the weeks, I was telling everyone I could that I think Scotland, slagging them off a little bit, just for a bit of fun, you know, a bit controversial.
Yeah.
Everyone's going how great they were. I mean, I was like, oh God. I think the biggest thing about them is that they're an extremely different team away from Murrayfield, and their results are like ridiculous. If they're away from the Murrayfield, the games suddenly, for some reason, seem a lot harder. And then you can't, and if you've got good teams at Murrayfield, then obviously that's going to be a hard game as well. So, I mean, England at Murrayfield, I think, I'm not sure how much of a fun game it's going to be. So I have a feeling it's going to be a bit of a bore fest. But I think England will come out top, and I genuinely think England, if they can sort out them, if they can sort themselves out, I think at Twickenham, England stand a good chance of beating Ireland. In Dublin, I think it would be a different matter, but I think England could probably still take it.
Well, I'll hold my hands up and say that I did think Scotland would fare a lot better against Wales. I think everyone was disappointed with that performance. I mean, the fact that they didn't put any points on the board, I think, goes to show that they didn't play anywhere near their best. I did touch on, though, in the preview, that Scotland's forward pack is significantly weaker than it was in the Autumn Internationals. They're without Ross Ford, they're without WP Nell, who are both seasoned Lions players, and they're at the heart of that Scotland pack. So without them, they have struggled, and I think that's probably the main reason why they're not going to fare as well in the Six Nations as a lot of people anticipated. I think with a full strength team, it may have been a different matter, and Scotland would give England a lot harder game at Murrayfield. But ultimately, I do think England are going to come through. And going back to your initial question, Matt, I still think England are going to come out as victors in this year's Six Nations. I think the crucial thing is that they have got Ireland at Twickenham as opposed to Dublin this year, and I think that's going to be the all-important factor.
Yeah, kind of echoing what the two lads have said, I think I was backing Scotland to do big things, and I thought the fixture England-Scotland at Murrayfield would be a bit of a problem, but now I think it will just be a boring game with England eventually taking the win. Still think England will win, pretty much because England-Ireland is in Twickenham this year, unlike last year. But again, that could be a boring game as well. As an England fan, I don't really care so long as England win. But yeah, no, I think England will still take the win, but not kind of as convincingly as past couple of years.
Yeah, I think, James, do you want to chip in just before we go through some?
England just appear unstoppable at the minute, don't they? But I wouldn't write off Ireland just yet, and I'm not just saying that because of the Irish blood in me.
Well, I think that brings to a nice conclusion our roundup of the Six Nations and our preview for the weeks to come. You might have got a bit sick and tired of talking about cricket in Australia over the last few months, but we're going to do it again. England have just started the 2020 Tourist Series with England, with Australia and New Zealand, and they haven't had the best start, have they, Ollie?
No, they really haven't. I think a couple of weeks ago we were talking about how England's fortunes with cricket might have taken an upturn with a convincing one-day series win over Australia, but since then we've lost three T20s in a row, two against Australia and one against New Zealand today. It looks like we're going to have to talk about England in a negative light again. To be completely honest, though, I think this whole tri-series thing is relatively pointless. It's obviously just a transition series where England are moving over from Australia to New Zealand, where they're going to play a few more one-day matches and then a couple of tests coming up in a few weeks' time, which I am interested to see how we fare in. Obviously, hopefully we'll have Ben Stokes back by then. I'm sure we're going to touch on this in a minute, Matt, but he's been cleared to play by the ECB again, so that's going to be interesting, and hopefully this whole saga is finally going to be put to bed. But yeah, with the whole tri-series thing, I think a lot of the England players are suffering from burnout. Some of England's best players and Joe Root have sat this series out because it's not really a big thing, I don't think, so I wouldn't read too much into it. I still think England are one of the best T20 teams in the world on their day.
So what do you think, guys, has been the main problem with this? Has it been a lack of depth in our batting and general tiredness of players? They've obviously been there for months and months. Is it a bridge too far in the end?
Yeah, I think I definitely think there's been so much cricket being played by them and so much more left to come. I'm not sure how much more you can use it as an excuse, but I'm saying that Stokes' removal from the team really destroyed the batting lineup in terms of how it works. I mean, I think that's true up to a point in terms of it doesn't necessarily affect the top half of the batting order, and they haven't been playing particularly well. It seems like our batsmen are really just very inconsistent out there. You got, like, except for Milan. I'm a big fan of Milan now.
I love Milan.
I think this is one of the best things to come out of this tour is Milan.
I had a very negative first impression of him because I was actually there for his debut test innings at the Oval. And he got his stumps flattened by a really good Yorker by Rabada. So I thought, oh, there goes another one. But yeah, he's been phenomenal actually this win. He's probably been our best player, you'd have to say, across the formats.
Yeah, probably. Definitely.
So, I think he's an exciting prospect. But yeah, as Ollie mentioned, we can't really have a cricket show without talking about Ben Stokes, can we? This is the news that Ben Stokes will join the England squad in New Zealand after appearing at Bristol Magistrates Court on Tuesday on a charge of affray. So the first hearing of his trial is scheduled for the 12th of March at Bristol Crown Court, although he's not actually required to attend it, so we will be seeing him in New Zealand playing for England again. Ollie, how much of a relief is it for us to finally have him back?
I think it's obviously a massive relief that he's finally back, because he is one of England's most integral players. The biggest relief is just for the whole saga to be put to bed, though, because there's been so much media coverage on it. I think that had a significant impact on England's team. I think that probably demoralised them somewhat, seeing so much media coverage around that. And that almost sparked some of the other issues that we saw. The whole Johnny Bairstow incident, I think the Lions player Ben Duckett, when he supposedly threw a drink over James Anderson, all those incidents were heightened off the back of the Ben Stokes saga. And because of that, I think that's why England significantly struggled. Not saying that the outcome would have been different. I think everyone knew that Australia were favourites going into the series, and I think they would have won regardless, but I think we probably would have seen a lot better showing had that saga not happened. So it's going to be obviously going to be pleasing to see Ben Stoke back in the lineup, and he's going to be integral for this up and coming series against New Zealand. But just not seeing another article on the whole thing is going to be the most pleasing thing for me.
I think the England cricket team really wants to put this to bed and move forward. We're just focusing on their cricket rather than talking about Ben Stokes. But moving back to the 2020s then, has it been concerning for you, Fred, that, the man of the defeats have been so comprehensive? I mean, Australia walked to victory inside 14 overs the other night. That's quite worrying for England in terms of both their batting and bowling.
Yeah, I mean, the way we have lost has been very bad, definitely. But I agree with what was said earlier. I don't think this matters too much. And I think we know our batsmen have got the capability to be, almost World Cup winning side. So I don't think there's that much worry there. I think you've got people like Butler, who just when he turns on, he turns on, and he's one of the best players in the world. And you've got people just there. I think it's just the potential that they have is not going to change. No matter the result of this. So I think once perhaps we can have like a nice refreshed period after this thing. It's a start anew. Everyone can just begin again.
I think the important thing to remember from this as well is that I would say Australia are the best T20 side in the world at the minute. You look at their team, and other than David Warner, pretty much everyone else in that team are new and up and coming internationals. They've also played a hell of a lot of T20 cricket at the minute with the Big Bash going on, so they're fresh and used to having played these T20 matches, whereas the England players have been used to playing these longer formats, the one days, the test matches. So yeah, I really wouldn't read that too much into it. The New Zealand result today was fairly disappointing, but we really didn't lose by that much, and I think it was more a case that New Zealand superstars in Martin Guptill and Kane Williamson both put on a show earlier, and had we got them out a bit earlier, the result would have been significantly different. I'm interested to see how our next game against New Zealand is going to fare, because there is still one match to go for England in this tri series, and if New Zealand lose against Australia and England beat New Zealand, they could actually still make the final against Australia, which would be pretty unfair considering how poorly we've performed in the three matches so far. But yeah, I really wouldn't be surprised to see England take a win in their remaining T20 game. We've definitely got the squad on paper. We've got our superstars in Joss Butler, Jason Roy, pretty much everyone in that top six can be a match winner on their day, so I definitely wouldn't read that much into it, to be completely honest with you. And I wouldn't be surprised if we're sat here next week talking about how England are going to be in the final against Australia.
Yeah, I mean, just before we go to a quick song break, are there any changes you guys make to the teams, or is it just simply that our big players just haven't quite hit their straps, really? I mean, obviously I think Ben Stokes comes back into the side probably for Sam Billings when he's fit again, but are there any changes you would see in the batting or bowling lineup?
Yeah, well, Billings is obviously a fantastic utility player for England, I think. He's proved he's played a lot in the Big Bash, he's played a lot in the IPL, and he's proved what a good T20 player he is. He's not, though, as good as Joss Butler, I think people would argue. He's a second-choice wicketkeeper at best, and when there is an injury, he's the perfect player to come back into the side. I think Stokes would obviously replace him, and I think however well Milan's played, you'd bring Joe Root back into the team if you're playing a proper T20 match. If it comes to the T20 World Cup in a couple of years' time, Joe Root will come straight back into the side. I think he's proven how good he is in all three formats, and you looked at how well Kane Williamson did today, and Joe Root's a very similar player. Even in T20, even though he's not the biggest of hitters, he's not like a Ben Stokes, he's not like an Alex Hales, he still scores very quickly, and he solidifies that England team, and it's very rare that he doesn't make a score even in T20 matches. So I think there'd be the two natural replacements to come back into the side. I think we've pretty much got our bowling lineup spot on. You've got the left arm seam and David Willey, the two quicks in Liam Plunkett and Mark Wood, and the leg spinner in Ada Rashid, who's definitely becoming a one day T20 specialist. So I think the team's almost spot on, and with those two people to come back into the side, England have more than enough chance of winning the World Cup again, perhaps.
Talk about rugby league. So, James, I think the big rugby league story in the moment is the fact that we've had our first ever Super League fixture in Australia.
Yes, we have. It was not the Warrington Wolves. It was the Wigan Warriors against Hull FC in Australia. It was an initiative by Super League kind of to expand the game overseas. Wigan's chairman Ian Lennigan actually came out after the game and said, the aim really is to take Super League and kind of expand it across Europe and overseas. Wigan won the game 24-10. It was a really impressive performance by Wigan, but the main positive that came out of the game was the crowd. Actually, there was 12,000 present, and over 5,000 or so Wigan fans had travelled all the way over there. So
wow.
Incredible effort. Wow. By the Super League fans, but also by the Australian natives who came out to watch the game. Obviously, the NRL, the National Rugby League in Australia, it's a massive competition, but to come and watch two English sides locking horns, it was a fantastic initiative, and I'm sure the Super League will try and continue with similar programmes in the future. Speaking of which, this week coming up, we've got the World Club Challenge. This is when the best of Australia meets the best of Britain. On Friday morning, 9 o'clock kickoff, we've got the Melbourne Storm against the Leeds Rhinos. Leeds coming off the back of an impressive victory on Thursday night against Hull Kingston Rovers at Elland Road. Incidentally, Headingley, their stadium, is currently undergoing a renovation. So the game was played at Elland Road. And also Wigan and Hull have stayed over in Australia. Hull play St George Illawarra on Saturday the 17th, and Wigan play the South Sydney Rabbitohs, who Wigan have kind of a connection with because of their former head coach Michael Maguire was the head coach of South Sydney Rabbitohs, and it's also the club which the Burgess brothers play for, obviously Sam and George. Two of English Rugby League's kind of finest exports. In terms of the games this weekend, just a roundup of kind of the action. It was another disappointing week for Warrington under their new coach Steve Price. He's come in, promised real radical changes to the Wolves side, who've been knocking on the door of the Super League title for many, many years, but have been unable to get over, to get through. They were defeated 20-6 away at the Huddersfield Giants. A very, very disappointing performance by all accounts by Warrington. On Friday night, Wakefield narrowly beat Salford 14-12. Salford had some opportunities late on in the game to get something from it, but Wakefield just about had enough to get through. Catalan in France were defeated 21-12 by St Helens. Saints were down to 12 men, incidentally. Morgan Knowles sent off, the first sending off of the Super League season. And Castleford, who finished top of the pile last season, they got a win, bouncing back from a really humiliating result and performance against Saints the previous week. They beat Widnes 13-12. By all accounts, not a convincing performance by Cass. Still question marks over how they're going to replace Zach Hardacre, obviously a key man for them last season, but was suspended by the club ahead of the Super League Grand Final last year for incidents off the field. And Cass haven't really brought in an out-and-out replacement for them. They've kind of shifted players that are in their starting 13 into positions that they're not necessarily comfortable with. But a win's a win, and Daryl Powell said it feels like Cass are back on track, and that can only be a good thing for the competition.